Welcome to the Promise Institute podcast, where we share critical conversations on human rights, a production of the Promise Institute for Human Rights at UCLA Law. Be sure to stay tuned after the episode to learn about ways to follow the Institute and to support our work.
Hello, and welcome to this series of podcasts in which we'll be talking about the proposed new international crime of ecocide. I'm Kate McIntosh of the Promise Institute for Human Rights at UCLA School of Law, and this series is timed to coincide with the launch of our online symposium or collection of papers under the title An International Crime of Ecocide, New Perspectives. The symposium examines ecocide from a whole range of different angles, such as how ecocide might contribute to environmental justice and reparations for climate harms, how to establish the mental element of the crime, how it might best be brought into law, as well as a number of case studies, including Jamaica, Brazil, and wildlife crime. The symposium papers can be found on the website that we host, along with the Stop Ecocide Foundation and the Human Rights Consortium at the University of London, ecocidelaw.com. Today, I'm with authors Geeta Parahar, independent environmental lawyer and advocate, Jonathan Lilleblad of the Australian National University, and Camilla Tade, consultant at No Peace Without Justice, to explore how ecocide relates to human rights, including the rights of women and Indigenous peoples, and to related concepts such as the rights of nature, and also to look at the importance of including the voices of those most affected in defining the crime. Before we get started, I should say that all of the papers in the symposium, including those we'll be discussing today, engage, although not necessarily exclusively, with the definition of ecocide proposed in June 2021 by the independent expert panel convened by the Stop Ecocide Foundation. I was a member of that panel, which was chaired by Philippe Sands and Dior Falsau. And more information about the panel and its proposed definition can be found on ecocidelaw.com. So Camilla, I'd like to start with you on the important fundamental issue you examine in your paper, which you co-authored with Juan José Guzmán, Valeria Napoli, Michelle Reyes-Milk and Alison Smith, and that is the importance of harnessing diverse and representative voices in defining a new crime of ecocide. So could you share your thoughts on not just the benefits, but on the obligation of looking to those voices in shaping the new crime?
Yes, thank you, Kay. And hello to all our listeners. So, well, we do have, and we argue in our paper that we do have an obligation to include all relevant voices, especially those of the affected peoples and groups within this process of framing and building this new crime of ecocide. These obligations are not just ethical, but they are also legal. On the ethical side, we argue that we need to consider their perspectives of the affected groups, because we should bear in mind that often the impacts of environmental destruction are often borne by those who contributed the least. And these groups are usually vulnerable and with limited resources to cope with the consequences. There are additional reasons for which we need actually to bring in those voices. And it's also for a difference in technical perspectives. We would bring in different experts from different areas and countries. So we would not just have different perspectives based on the culture and on the geographical context in which certain groups live, but also we would have a multidisciplinary approach within this process. But it is not just an ethical matter. It is indeed a legal obligation that we have. In fact, in the paper, we argued that there is a right to participation and consultation where the codification of rules that are important to the environment and to the affected groups exists. And this extends beyond domestic matters. We argue that it should, and it actually, there is an obligation to include also in international law processes as well. And in this case, we believe it also includes international criminal law. Therefore, this right to consultation is true. It's not just a dream. This obligation exists. And there has been relevant case law, as we show in the paper, to support this argument. One of the key examples is given from the case law of the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, but also by the civil society participation within the Rome Statute. And therefore, we think that those consultations should reach communities affected by environmental destructions besides the usual fora, the usual centers of international law. But when I talk about voices, so including these voices, I'm referring to collective voices as well, not just individual voices. So this goes beyond individual voice of a victim, but it refers to including collective voices that are representative not only of affected group, but also of groups and societies that are often silenced. This is important because it is not just a matter of legitimacy and representation, but it's also key when we reflect on who should be the pen holder in the process and who is writing the rules in the process. So, of course, this has numerous benefits, as you have addressed. And one of them is really including other forms of knowledge that would enrich the process of identifying and solving the problems, but also countering colonial dynamics, if we want to use this term. So, of course, on the one hand, we would acknowledge agency and expertise of certain groups, such as in the case of youth, we would move beyond the adult-centric perspective that is very, very widespread in the current law and policy making. In the case of indigenous groups, for instance, we would involve them as separate from NGOs and other aspects so that they can bring in their different relationships with the environment that exist. So we would acknowledge those relationships that exist, attribute value to them, and potentially, I believe this is really one of the added values of this process, rethink the relationship between nature and humans in a more ecocentric way. And also, this will lead to an increased recognition of the interconnection between human rights and the well-being of environments, because we bring in these different perspectives. And also, we would recognize the right of indigenous peoples to juridical personality.
I was pleased to see that you were, you know, somewhat approving actually of the way that the independent expert panel had gone about bringing different voices, although perhaps it wasn't, you know, quite the sort of fully inclusive process you're talking about. I don't know if you could just say a couple of words about how you thought the independent expert panel had, you know, to what degree you thought they'd been successful in including a diverse group of voices.
Well, actually, I think the independent expert panel managed to provide a very good example of such inclusion. I still think that, as you said, there could have been perhaps an even more inclusive approach. So by bringing in relevant groups from different areas of the world, from areas that have been severely affected by certain environmental acts to the environment, and especially groups that have a different understanding of the relationship between humans and the environment. But I think while this has been a very good example in the beginning, so far, I think it is really important to keep up with this action, with this commitment, also in the next steps. So if as we argue also in the paper, if the new crime of ecocide gets in the agenda of an ASP discussion or of an amendment within the Rome Statute, it is important that throughout the entire process, those groups are really, really involved and have a participation that is not just about mere listening, but it is about really, truly taking into account their perspectives and their different worldviews and understandings of certain issues. And again, the relationship between humans and nature.
Yeah, I think that's a really helpful perspective moving forward and chimes with many of the things you look at in your paper, Jonathan, where you're also thinking about how the crime of ecocide should evolve. Your paper also pays attention to the intersectionality, which Camilla and her co-authors look at in hers. I wonder if you could summarize for us, Jonathan, your main thoughts on intersectionality as concerns a definition of a crime of ecocide, and perhaps put that into the context of the situation that you focus on, which is post-coup Myanmar.
Thanks, Kate, and thanks for inviting me today. The gist of my paper is essentially talking about the difficulties in dealing with ecocide purely in terms of environmental issues, and that it's not always a straightforward process to think about the environment as separate from a range of other political, economic, social, cultural contexts. So in particular, the case studies I was looking at was in relation to Myanmar. And there, there we have a situation where historically 60% of the country's natural resources activities reside in lands occupied by 40% of the country's people. And that 40% are the ethnic minorities throughout the country's history, and this predates even the British arrival in the 1800s, lay towards the frontiers in the north, the east, the west, and the south. And these were outside of the Baba-dominated areas of the country. The situation that is happening right now is that the environment has become a point of contestation, not just because of the natural resource wealth, but also because of its political value in the country's current struggles. In particular, you have a situation where the environment, again, because of the natural resource wealth, is a source of revenue for ongoing conflicts. It's a source of revenue for corrupt leaders. And it's a zero-sum game where anyone who is able to seize control of the environment is denying the environment to somebody else. And so it's a situation where the country's military, the Tatmadaw, which is dominated by the ethnic Bama group, knows that if they're able to seize control of the environment, they seize control of resources that include timber, wildlife trafficking, petroleum, natural gas, gemstones, and gain control of the revenues from those sources, but in the process also deny the benefits of those materials to the various pro-democracy ethnic movements. Beyond that, it's also a means of pacification, where it's solidifying capital power of the military, while at the same time also suppressing claims of self-determination by a lot of the ethnic movements. Now, I'm using the term ethnic movement simply because this is tied to the ethnic armed organizations, the EAOs, which is a label that's been used by the United Nations as well as others. However, I should note that these comprise indigenous movements. So a lot of these groups, even though they are labeled by the international community as ethnic armed organizations, are actually indigenous movements where they claim indigenous status and they recognize traditional territories, and hence they're asserting these claims of self-determination. So the consequence of all of this is that the environment is extremely difficult to separate it out from these larger political, cultural, social issues. And then when we're talking about ecocide and we're trying to criminalize the idea of damage to the environment and something that we call ecocide, we have to consider what the ramifications are in relation to all of these other factors. With respect to the Stop Ecocide Foundation definition, as a point, I'll note the first criteria talks about unlawful or wanton acts. And the case of Myanmar, in my mind, actually poses a bit of a complication. It depends on who you talk to, right? So this goes back to Camila's point, which is if we rely on the state definitions, we're basically relying on the military's, the Tatmadaw's definitions of ecocide, simply because they're in control of the instruments of the state. And in their minds, they've leveraged the instruments of the state to pass laws that justify military control of environmental resources, that further centralized control of the environment under a military-controlled state. And as a result, everything that they're doing to take over the environment, to seize control of natural resource activities, is entirely lawful. In addition, from the military's perspective, it's not wanton, because all of their activities to suppress access to natural resources, to deny control of the environment to indigenous movements or the ethnic armed organizations, is a way of pacifying the country and suppressing pro-democracy movements. So therefore, from the military's perspective, it's not wanton. As a result of this, what I'm trying to do, or at least what I try to do in my paper, is to pose the case of Myanmar as a way of encouraging the Stop Ecocide Foundation to think through a little bit more about some of the complications about trying to criminalize situations in the environment, separate from a lot of these other intersectional issues that I have encountered.
That's so interesting. And I think the kind of national security angle that you bring in, that is really a new one, you know, that I haven't seen discussed so much in terms of what does that do to the justifications. We immediately think about economic interests as a kind of structural barrier to criminalizing some of this environmental destruction. But the national security angle, I think, is really important to think about as well. So I really encourage people to read Jonathan's fantastic paper. I'd like to move to India now and to your paper, Geeta, which looks at ecocide and the destruction of culture in the context of Indian rivers. So how might ecocide apply in this situation?
So in my paper, I really wanted to explore a little bit this idea of the cultural dimensions of ecocide. And the definition proposed by the expert panel does cover grave impacts on cultural resources. the position of Indigenous peoples comes to mind because they are so embedded, their life ways are so embedded in their local environments and culture. But in my paper, I look at a different context, which is the Eastern traditions, which also have very often ecocentric perspectives. And I discuss this in the context of particular rivers in India, which are regarded as sacred in a number of traditions and also regarded as goddesses within the Hindu tradition. And despite this, these rivers are heavily, heavily polluted. Indeed, some of the most polluted rivers in the world. So severe impacts, both for humans and for a number of different species, including crocodiles and river dolphins, which are all endangered. There's been ongoing protests and litigation, but that hasn't really made a difference. The rivers are biologically dead in places. So I look at this in the context of what does that mean if the river is a culturally regarded as sacred or as a goddess? So there are acts of worship, for example, such as bathing in the river that can no longer happen. They're offering flowers if the flowers are contaminated with pesticides and chemicals. That can no longer happen. You're starting to see this within terms of the restrictions or the sense that people feel that perhaps this isn't the right thing to be doing anymore, quite legitimately. But when we look at environmental action, a really cool way in that happens, in which we see that happening, is through connection with nature and with rivers. So all of these, what is happening effectively, is these ways of connection, these cultural ways of engaging, are being reduced to being limited. And that, of course, means that there is more of a risk of environmental harm, and it creates a vicious cycle. So that's something I really started exploring in my paper, and how the ecocide definition could speak to that.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful paper, which I really loved reading. Could you talk a little bit about what difference practically you think an international crime of ecocide might make to this situation?
So I think the first thing to say is that ecocide, the definition, is designed to deal with the most egregious and severe impact of environmental harm, and parts of a river being dead are, you know, that is that seems to fall squarely within the idea of what's being talked about. So that's a very direct impact. But I think what's also interesting are the aspects of the International Criminal Court statute that encompass reparative measures prior to judgment. And I think this is really important because what we're really discussing in a cultural context is relationships and relationships with the river. So if alongside the acceptance of harm and responsibility for harm, there's support for restoration and maintenance of those relationships with the rivers. So working with the communities who live by the rivers and who depend on them, whether or not they regard them as sacred. So it's important to say in the Indian context that it's a secular country. It has a range of different faiths and traditions, including faiths that wouldn't see the rivers as sacred. But the coming back to what the other participants have also been saying, the really important need to engage those communities that are most impacted and have those direct relationships in discussing how do we make reparation, how do we engage, and how do we maintain these relationships that are actually so important for the survival of our relationship with the planet and a viable planet in general.
I think all of you have touched on this idea of the opposition of ecocentrism to anthropocentrism and the relationship between humans and nature, whether humans are separate from nature and so on. I'd love to just go into that a little bit. I don't know if I could ask you, Camilla. You sort of analysed that dualist vision in your paper. Maybe you could give us a quick summary just to kick off that part of the conversation.
Yeah, as you have said, I mean, there is usually a dualistic perception of anthropocentrism versus ecocentrism. And, well, of course, anthropocentrism, as the name suggests, is an approach focused on humans, where humans are at the center, and therefore nature, animals, rivers, and everything are perceived as objects. So it is also difficult to see what is wrong with exploiting them that we call resources without limitation, or it's often even difficult to understand that some actions may be detrimental to the environment itself. So here in anthropocentrism, there is also a dualism between nature, which is often referred to as the giver, and humans, who are the takers. And we see them in anthropocentrism, they are seen as the natural, let's say, dualism, where humans are and have to be the takers. Whereas ecocentrism sees nature as having its own intrinsic value, regardless of whether it is used for humans or not. And humans here are really just one component of a more comprehensive system, of a more comprehensive ecosystem. And they're not above any of the other elements of the ecosystem, but they're really at the same level. So equal parts of a unique ecosystem. But if we look at our world, well, we see that, as we also say in the paper, that anthropocentrism is highly prevalent and it has been highly institutionalized. So in Western-driven and capitalistic-driven, let me use that word, societies, non-anthropocentric perspectives have been excluded. And also when we talk about legal actions and legal frameworks, we see this clearly in the case of environmental harm. So all of the current, or most of at least, the current legal frameworks are essentially anthropocentric. So when there is a damage to the environment, it is often criminalized because it has a direct impact on human beings. And anthropocentrism is indeed the dominant approach, even within the debates of environmental law and environmental impacts. What we argue in the paper is that there should be a more ecocentric perspective, because this would help address environmental harm, whereby no direct human harm is made, because in many cases, environmental destruction happens in a way that does not impact directly humans, and we have to address that. As Gita was saying, also for the well-being of our planet, also to prevent and restore and repair what has been done.
And maybe I should say that there is, of course, ecocentric element in the definition proposed by the expert panel. But I wanted to pick up on one of the things you refer to. So you talk about how international law and environmental law is overwhelmingly anthropocentric, but there is, of course, a burgeoning movement around rights of nature. And Gita, this is something that you look at in your paper. I wonder if you could talk about whether rights of nature is necessarily in opposition to a human rights approach, and maybe where ecocide fits into that picture.
So, really interesting and I think very important question. So I think there are limbs on which complementarity and relationships can be built between the two. I'm thinking about the UN General Assembly resolution on the right to healthy environment, which makes clear that human rights are also there for the protection of the environment. It's not just about the environment being instrumentalized for humans. I think Camilla's right that there is an anthropocentric dimension also to the environmental law and the way it's used. But it has been interesting to see how environmental law concepts have been incorporated into human rights approaches and judgments. So, for example, concepts like equity and climate justice, recognizing, you know, human rights can be very individualistic, it's individual versus states, but sort of recognizing things like the fact that the people most impacted by climate change are often part of communities or countries that are already suffering from post-colonialism and extractivism, and bringing in these concepts, we have seen that happen in the human rights context. Another point worth making is that, of course, human rights protect cultural and religious values and beliefs, and many of those are not necessarily oppositional in any way. So talking about, you know, indigenous beliefs or beliefs within Eastern traditions, all of those which we've been discussing do see humans in a very different relationship to nature as part of a wider macrocosm and this idea of relationship. And those beliefs are automatically protected under the human rights context, which means that they then become part of the worldviews that need to be considered. So I actually see that there are definitely points of connection, and that can be developed, and that there doesn't necessarily need to be an automatically oppositional approach. And I think ecocide is really interesting in this context because, as we've been discussing, it does include an ecocentric perspective. And I can see how it can be a bridge between the two in that way, as well as being kind of hard edge, sort of dealing with the most egregious and severe aspects of harm to both humans and wider ecosystems and the environment.
That's great. And Jonathan, I think this intersects with some of your thinking in your paper as well. I don't know if you have any reflection.
Yeah. And this is sort of the legal corollary that comes out of this, is that we have to start thinking through the purpose of ecocide and promoting justice, that if it's going to promote justice, Does it address both sides or both directions of that kind of discourse? Does it recognize the fact that environmental harms cause human harms? Conversely, does it recognize that human harms can cause environmental harms? And then if we're going to promote justice and we're going to try and promote justice with both of those relationships, then in what way does it accommodate the perspectives that are aware of those kinds of connections? And so hence the reason why I think all three of us have been promoting these marginal voices, particularly with Indigenous peoples, because they're much more sensitive to those kinds of connections. The last thing I'll mention, and this is sort of my own personal take, is that I think that one way the Stop Ecocide Foundation and a lot of participants in the Ecocide discourses can work through this is maybe from a prosecutorial perspective, what kind of strategies are going to be used when they're going to prosecute crimes, international crimes, and what form of justice are they going to try and promote? If justice really is about marginalized voices, marginalized human voices, marginalized natural voices, then is it simply enough to have ecocide treated in isolation, or are we having to look at ecocide as an element or as a charge that treated strategically in combination with other international crimes like genocide? And in which case, how do they fit together, right? And how would a prosecutor combine them all to achieve this larger question of justice that's affecting both humans and the environment? So thanks.
A wonderful big picture and very important thoughts, Jonathan. Thank you. Camilla, any last words from you?
I would like just briefly to point out that while we all argue for the importance of including these affected groups and relevant groups within discussion, I think we do not, and that is open for discussion and further thoughts, we do not address how that should be done in certain ways. And that is also part of the challenges of this process, where there are obligations, where there are needs to do so, and important advantages in having this. So we should start thinking about how to do this without risking replicating discriminatory patterns, and also with an eye to make these processes truly accessible and also without any tokenism. So ensuring that that participation is truly, truly meaningful and that contributions from given groups or populations are truly taken into account, including reparations, as Gita was also referring to.
Thank you so much. And I really encourage all listeners to read Camilla and her co-authors' a really excellent paper, which sets out all of these arguments in more detail. Gita, any closing words from you?
Yeah, I was thinking of the quote that's often misattributed to Einstein, that you can't solve a problem with the same thinking that created it. And I think that's really relevant to what we've been talking about here and bringing in voices and thinking that is very different to the way that environmental issues have been approached up till now. And I think really, while we're talking about individual case studies and corporations and cases, and that level of engagement is really important. But I think what we're really speaking to in these papers, I think across the board, is that we're really looking now at what's our relationship as humans with the wider world. How do we interrelate with it? And how do we have an ecosystem that reflects values that are going to create a flourishing relationship, both for humans and the other beings with whom we share this planet? That ultimately is the goal here, and these are really important discussions towards that.
Wonderful. Well, thank you all very much. As a reminder, this podcast is one in a series of conversations around different aspects of the proposed new international crime of ecocide. The series is timed to coincide with the launch of our online symposium on the same topic, which you can find on ecocidelaw.com. Each of our interviewees on the podcast, including the three that have been with me today, has authored one of the 15 short papers on the site, on issues ranging from how ecocide applies to bauxite mining in Jamaica or to international wildlife crime, to how it might best be brought into law, contribute to environmental justice, or, as we heard today, interact with the rights of nature, among other things. The site also hosts a regularly updated annotated bibliography, which lists and summarises publications on ecocide, as well as information on the proposed definition and legal developments around the world. So if you want to know more, visit ecocidelaw.com.
Look for the Promise Institute on social media. You can find us under the handle @PromiseInst UCLA. And please consider supporting our work by making a donation. Visit law.ucla.edu/supportpromise to contribute at any level and help make conversations like these possible. Last thing, make sure you're subscribed to the show to be sure to catch future episodes. Until next time, take care.